you're looking ahead 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, yeah. It's laying the foundation for predictable, consistent success. And it's not one thing. It's generally a few things. The hardest thing of all is probably it's the mindset.
Yes.
That you often have to change to genuinely create an organization that you can, hand on heart, say is innovative.
Welcome to AI for Pharma Growth, the podcast from pioneering pharma artificial intelligence entrepreneur, Dr. Andre Bates. This show aims to demystify AI for all those in biopharma, from startup biotech right through to big pharma. Each episode focuses on all things AI and future tech related to help pharma execs to navigate through the and benefit from the sometimes confusing but magical world of AI-powered tools to grow and get real-world results.
Today's episode is the future of leadership and innovation in pharma. While we've got a lot of exciting new technologies and techniques that have appeared that are really creating new medical interventions and approaches such as precision medicine, digital therapeutics, nanobots, quantum dots, as well as digital twins, and AI to predict conditions such as cancer in people with no symptoms, all of these advances are really wonderful for patients. However, they are likely to cause a fairly decent decrease in pharma revenue. Now, alongside that, we've got the upcoming patent cliff, and we're going to see around 236 billion holes in the market because we have about 200 drugs that have expiring patents in the next 7 years. And so this is causing pharma leaders to take some extreme measures, such as laying off thousands of staff. So navigating what's happening in our environment right now, and this is only a tip of the iceberg of some of the things going on, is going to mean that we're going to have to have some more radical and far-reaching change. And that's something that we as an industry are historically slow to accomplish. My guest today is Adam Kingle, a globally renowned expert in innovation management practice and strategy, leading the modern workforce. He's also an authority on generational paradigms in the workplace, the future of work and capitalism, and fulfilling organizational and personal purpose. He currently leads and develops executive education at prestigious institutions such as London Business School, Holt International Business School, Imperial College Business School, Moller Institute with Churchill College at the University of Cambridge, and UCL School of Management, where he helps boost the careers and the businesses of senior executives and high potential professionals. Thank you so much for being on the podcast today, Adam.
Thanks very much for having me.
I'm very excited to get a non-pharma perspective on all of this. So could you maybe start with a little bit about your background and how you got into leading in innovation management?
Well, I guess maybe the easiest way to answer the question is how I got involved in innovation specifically. And It was because I discovered a big gap. Mm-hmm. So to explain that, we'd have to go back about 5 years where I saw two completely independent surveys that displayed, I think, a deficit in our leadership capability. The first study was done by Boston Consulting Group, BCG, And they were surveying CEOs of top 200 global companies, asking, what are your top priorities? What are your top three priorities? And innovation or creativity showed up in 79% of those CEOs surveyed. So you've got to believe that it's incredibly important. These CEOs are saying there's nothing more important. Innovation, creativity, top of the list. Yeah. At the same time, and unbeknownst to BCG, McKinsey did a survey asking about creativity and innovation, but this time amongst the rank and file of organizations, large global organizations, asking them how good is your company at creativity and innovation? And something like 93, 94% said we're terrible at it. You know, we're absolute crap at innovation. Now, at the same time, all the CEOs are saying it's a top priority. Yeah. Yeah. So at that point, I thought, I'm not sure that there is a bigger gap in corporate life today between a single aspiration and the reality. That's why I set out to actually write my book, Sparking Success, which is about innovation and creativity in the workplace.
Wow, that's really interesting because I think that the people, the CEOs as well, confuse innovation in some ways because sometimes they are, like in pharma specifically, they're thinking, we're hugely innovative. What's this all about? But yes, we're hugely innovative in medical breakthroughs, but maybe not the rest of the business, I think, sometimes.
Yes, yeah, I think that's absolutely right. People generally go right to new products and services.
Yeah.
If we're producing new products and services, then we're innovative, not thinking about, are we innovating our processes and systems and our strategy and our management model, all of which actually, in many cases, have longer lasting competitive advantage. You just talked about this huge cliff coming up with patents. You know, that's an example of the industry not keeping up with product innovation, but that's an outcome of not innovating sufficiently in terms of your management model and your processes and your incentives, et cetera.
Exactly. And the business model. You know, I really strongly believe that the whole pharma business model, you know, which we've had for decades, maybe centuries, is really not fit for purpose in the environment that we're in today.
Yeah. So. And it's probably a product of its success, of its past success.
Yes, yes.
There's nothing like success sometimes to kill innovation in the future.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. And I did see a study that the majority of pharma CEOs believe that the number one factor driving revenue growth is new products. And so, of course, they're investing heavily in, you know, licensing new products, R&D, discovery, but we're not seeing the results as impressive as we would like. So that's why we've got this big gap. They're too slow to get to market. We're not seeing, you know, the size that they used to be. So lots of companies stave that off, this challenge with, you know, merger and acquisitions and soaring prices and line extensions and, you know, trying to extend their patents and things like that. But recently, in the last few weeks, we had the US government slash prices of 10 drugs. And of course, now we're seeing lawsuits from the pharma to the US government, which I'm not entirely sure is a good idea. So these kind of solutions aren't really sustaining us in the coming decades. What do you think pharma could do to be more innovative and inspirational in the way they address these challenges?
Well, everything you've just listed struck me as, you know, trying to put a Band-Aid on a hemorrhaging wound.
Absolutely.
So sure, maybe, you know, that gives you a reprieve for a couple of days, a few weeks, a few months, and keeps the shareholders off of your doorstep. But ultimately, what you want is consistent, predictable, innovative outputs.
Yeah.
And so, as I was saying before, you've got to work backwards for, well, how do you create great new products?
Yeah.
And as you said, it has something to do with your strategy. It has something to do with how you lead. It has something to do with who you hire. It has something to do with how you have them collaborate with one another. All of these things are, it reminds me in a way of when you have new territories like China or Saudi Arabia, who want to get into football or soccer, right?
Yeah.
You see them setting the stage for it. Yes, they have some big splashes where they hire premium players, but they have to create training programs, schools, where you're looking ahead 10 years, 20 years, 30 years.
Yeah.
It's laying the foundation for predictable, consistent success. And it's not one thing. It's generally a few things. The hardest thing of all is probably it's the mindset that you often have to change to genuinely create an organization that you can hand on heart say is innovative.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, well, back, you know, pharma are constantly restructuring, particularly now. I'm seeing a lot of companies going through restructures where there's massive layoffs and big teams of people being cut down to one or two people who are burnt out and overworked. And, you know, it's really, really hard. How can we make transformation and adaptability easier?
Well, if we think about what is genuine, you know, adaptability, some of it is, do I have an environment that rewards adaptability and agility?
Yeah.
Right? Because a lot of people would say, if I step outside my lane, I'm going to get my head chopped off.
Yeah.
And this comes back to, that's actually innovating your management model. How do you give people the freedom to explore, to be humble and curious, to say they don't always have the answers? So, you know, asking the uncomfortable question and pursuing the potentially dead end avenue, but you have to pursue it before you know if you're onto something or not. it reminds me of organizations, you know, like Google or 3M, who very famously, you know, give their people, for example, 20% discretionary time to pursue projects that they are personally passionate about, or 15% of your time, or 10% of your time, or whatnot. Yeah. And often, you know, when I speak to some leaders from, let's call them industrial age paradigms, they will say, yeah. "Oh yeah, but you know, you're just allowing those people to go golfing, you know, every Friday afternoon." You know, to which I have to say, well, look at what Google did, you know, with giving some of their engineers 20% time.
Yeah.
From that discretionary time, they created Gmail, they created Google Maps, they started exploring creating autonomous or semi-autonomous vehicles, they explored hot air balloons, broadcasting Wi-Fi to emerging economies that don't have internet.
Yeah. All,
and most of those things I've listed, except for the last one, are potentially huge earners for Google, huge money makers, massive profit. But notice they didn't plan what the product was.
Exactly.
What they instilled were the very human characteristics of humility, curiosity, exploration, and thought, well, how do we as an organization, A, give people permission, but B, celebrate that?
Yeah.
That's also, of course, the problem is you give people freedom to innovate. That also, by definition, means that many avenues of exploration won't come to anything. Now, in principle, pharma, I think, understands this. You know, they know not every molecule that they invent is going to be a multi-billion dollar winner. But I wonder, though, if in management we truly say, you know, you're going to come up with lots of ideas and, you know, one or two is going to be a supernova and a lot of them are going to fall by the wayside. The problem is we don't know which idea is the supernova.
Exactly.
So we have to look at the 20 to 50 ideas.
Yeah.
When I was writing my book and researching it, I wanted to look at arts organizations because, of course, they are filled to the brim with creativity and innovation.
Yeah.
And when I talked to people like creative writers and sitcom writers and showrunners of TV shows, where they have to, you know, the creative pressure is huge.
Yeah.
And what they said is the same thing, exact same thing. They said, look, a writer is typically going to propose 20 ideas for every one that's going to wind up on the screen.
Oh, wow.
So they said, my job as the leader of the writer's room, for example, is not to say, I just want to hear everyone's best idea, because you don't know what the best idea is.
Yeah.
Your idea is to encourage everyone to propose 20 ideas before the end of the day.
Yeah.
But leaders sometimes by default think that their job is to encourage ideas, but also evaluate and criticize the ideas at the same time, or even punish the bad ideas simultaneously.
Yeah.
And then they lament, well, no one gives me any good ideas anymore. Yeah, no kidding. Because you've been disincentivizing them all the time in how you behave toward them.
Yeah.
We also see, you know, very simple behavioral things like leaders and teams having a brainstorming meeting and the leader goes, okay, I want to hear everyone's best idea about ABC. I'll go first. No, don't. If the senior most person in the room goes first, everyone else is going to anchor what they say thereafter to that idea, because clearly the senior person wants their idea to be the one that people will take forward. So now everyone's job is basically to go, yes, boss, that's a great idea.
Yeah. It's interesting because Amazon is an interesting example, because that was one of their tenets in the Bezos letters of, you know, allow people to fail, you know, not random crazy stuff, you know, but you know, like Google has done with that 20% idea of their time.
Yeah.
It's allowing, for creating that environment where you can fail, but you could also succeed in a massive way.
Yeah. And it is a numbers game. Both Bezos and Schmidt, former CEO of Google, have both said in one form or another, our competitive advantage is to give our people more at-bats or shots on goal or whatever sports analogy you wish than any other competitor.
Yeah.
And that's how we get good ideas.
Yeah.
Rather than holding our people's feet to the fire to come up with that one brilliant idea.
Well, that does remind me of something I've seen in pharma for quite a few years now, which is a lot of innovation theater, which is like they'll have this big innovation day and then invite all these vendors with these random technologies and everyone will look at it and go, oh, look, we did this big innovation thing. It's just really looking at different things. So
it's you're right. It is theater. That's an app description, because then the person who organized it can could have put a big tick in their annual objectives and say, yeah, of course I've built innovation in the organization because I organized a fair.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, possibly, if to the extent that innovation partially can come from divergent ideas. So if you bring in people from outside your industry, your function, that can make a difference. But again, it's not sustainable. So maybe you get a one-off, you know, spike in, in people thinking of new things. But as I said before, I'm much more interested in what is sustainable.
Exactly.
And that requires leaders to change behaviors. That requires them to change habits. That's hard. That's the hard part about leadership, because leaders often, you know, somehow implicitly, I'm not saying people go around thinking this explicitly, but implicitly think, you know, my job as a leader is to be the expert. In other words, that means I always have the answer. If someone asks me a question, I'm supposed to have the answer. But actually, you know, in fast moving technology industry, in, you know, with Moore's Law and so many other areas indicating that we can't actually rely on the past to give us answers for future issues and opportunities, expertise actually is worth less and less. Curiosity and creating an environment where curiosity can thrive and the supernova ideas can genuinely be discussed and evaluated rather than shot down because, you know, it seems like it's too extreme. Those are the foundations that would have me be a net buyer of a given company instead of rating it a sell.
Absolutely. And what do you think organizations such as Pharma can do to become more human-centric?
Well, I mean, there are so many different things, and a lot of it just has to do with what I'll call micro habits, which is things leaders can do and say in everyday conversation that shift the culture. Because I think actually that's the headline is, I think we're due for a culture change.
Yes,
that's the best
way
to make it human centric.
Yeah.
The best definition I ever heard for the word culture was so simple and elegant and brilliant. It's just two words: shared behaviors. So if you want to identify a company's culture, observe the behaviors, particularly in its leaders and its role models and its bellwethers in the organization. That tells you what the culture is. It doesn't matter what the flashy, you know, annual report says to the shareholders about this is what our culture is. These are our cultural competencies. If I can't observe it anthropologically, then that's just greenwashing culture.
Exactly. Yeah.
So what that requires is the hard work of the leaders, the role models, to say, these are the behaviors we want a little bit more of, and these are the behaviors that we want to discourage and have a little bit less of. And this is the really hard part. If we agree to that, how do we hold one another to account?
Yeah.
So if I see you acting counterculturally, will I call you on it?
Yeah.
Hopefully, privately, in we'll sneak off to a private room, but I will hold you to account to this promise, because you know we rely on precedent and we think it's my behaviors to date have served me well, but perhaps not going forward. Of course, also implicit what I've just said is that culture has to evolve based on a company's context.
Mm.
So if you're having market pressure or competitive pressure or regulatory pressure, each of those might require adjustments to your culture.
Yeah.
So culture is never one thing that is frozen and becomes fixed for eternity.
Yeah.
So it's always worth evaluating, is our culture fit for purpose today versus 5 years ago? And so, you know, related to, so what are some behaviors? Well, one is to say, if you tried something and it didn't work, how do we A, acknowledge it and encourage it, but celebrate it?
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things that was in that I talk about in my book is organizations that hold failure parties. I mean, literally failure parties. The point is not you failed, hooray. The point is, look how many different avenues we've explored this month.
So
now we get an idea, not of course what, not just what the failures are, but maybe what are the curious avenues that we may want to adjust, explore differently, talk to different people around. But also, of course, even if it is an abject failure, you just taught 20 other colleagues what not to do.
Exactly.
For what, don't waste your time to explore this area. That's valuable.
Yeah.
But most organizations will repress that information because it's against the reputation of the person who tried the new thing.
Yeah.
I surveyed a few years ago 200 European HR directors asking, what is your organization's attitude toward failure? And I gave them five options. And it was a range, as you can imagine. On one end was, if you fail, you're fired, you know, rapidly. It will never. All the way to top would be, you know, we hold failure parties, we celebrate and share, and there's no stigma attached to it. Most organizations, unfortunately, fell in the first three categories that I've listed, you know, from basically you're fired to at best, well, we won't speak of it again. It's we're not fired, but it's just best that we bury the bodies on that one. So of course these organizations, it should come as no surprise if these organizations say, oh, we're not very innovative or creative, which, you know, 93% of these people in this McKinsey survey said.
This is
one of the big underlying reasons why these organizations aren't creative, because human beings are filled to the brim with curiosity, innovation, creativity, adaptability. And yet when we come together in these social constructs that we call companies, what we generally experience is a deficit of these characteristics. But surely there must be ways when we come together to be have an exponential explosion of these characteristics, when all of a sudden you're collaborating and mixing all of these people with these massive capabilities in new and interesting ways. So there must be something around the management that is making that is repressing the natural abilities that we have as humans that can also become our company's primary competitive advantage.
It reminds me of a story, and I don't remember which company it was, but there was something I read decades ago about someone who made a mistake in their company and cost the company some crazy amount. I don't know, 10 million, 100 million, some many, many millions. And they were called into the CEO's office and they thought, okay, this is it. I'm done. I'm being fired. And he just said to the CEO, I understand, you know, it's my fault and I'll just pack my desk. And the CEO said, what? I've just spent, say, $10 million educating you. You're not going anywhere.
So, exactly. You know, I think that was IBM.
I think it was too. I had in the back of my mind it was IBM, but I wasn't 100% sure.
Yeah. So I think the CEO in question was Watson. Yeah. Who said that? Yeah. It's a great story. You're right. I've invested in your education.
Yeah, a huge amount.
And now I want a return on my investment.
Exactly.
But,
You're not going anywhere.
Fire you. Yeah. That's right.
Exactly.
It's completely right. And yes, you know, I don't want listeners to think exploration and, you know, having discretionary time and whatnot is just chaos. You know, everyone can just spend an infinite amount of money and exploring an infinite amount of avenues. It's quite all right for the leader of a team or an organization to set the boundaries. Mm. You have X amount of time per week to innovate, or you have X amount of dollars to spend on new ideas. Mm. As a matter of fact, what I learned in research in my book is that that's a creative stimulus, not a creative a distraction or a handicap.
Yeah.
Every creative leader I talked to said, if I have those boundaries, that actually sparks me in a certain direction.
Yeah.
You know, if you say build the tallest tower out of toothpicks you can, okay, then I'll go at it. But if you say build the tallest tower and you have exactly 100 toothpicks, that actually helps me to think through the problem. It reminds me of this wonderful quotation from Leonard Bernstein, right? The world famous composer and conductor who said, to achieve great things, two things are needed, a good idea and not quite enough time. You know, basically saying, yes, if you had infinite amount of time, after a while, you don't get any
further. There's no urgency with it. Yeah,
there's no urgency.
Like, I'll do it tomorrow.
And then you're just messing about, you know, you're just doodling with the idea. You're no longer going to get any further return on the investment of your time or effort. And I think I truly believe that's true. I see it all the time. I run exercises to illustrate the point. If you say, you know, here's an objective or a challenge and you watch the team trying to achieve it, you know, how quickly can they do it, or how effectively can they do it, or what kind of, you know, return can they get? But then if you say, achieve this challenge or opportunity, and these are the barriers, or these are the rules, or these are the restrictions, they generally, and I mean way more than 50%, outperform. the teams that are just given no barriers, no criteria at all.
That's really interesting. What about how do you think managers can make organizations more fit for purpose and bust bureaucracy?
Bureaucracy is a big part of it, right? A lot of people say, well, I could innovate in theory, but there's so much red tape I have to get through that it's just, you know, I've lost the will to live just thinking about it, let alone doing it. So I would actually say, if you want to bust bureaucracy to enhance innovation or agility or what have you, I would say answer three questions about your organization. And the solution is implicit in each question.
Yeah.
The questions are, one, how many people have to approve you're pursuing a good idea, a new idea?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the lower the number, the better.
Yeah.
The higher the number, the more that tells you you've got too much bureaucracy in the system. Second, related point, how easy is it? How fast in days or weeks is it to get a little bit of resource, be it a little bit of money or maybe the help of a colleague to explore or prototype a new idea?
Yeah.
And again, you know, lower amount of time, the better.
Yeah.
Third, is every manager, every person responsible for other people in that company, personally incentivized for the innovation in their team? It is one of their personal objectives to enhance and increase innovation in their team. Because if it isn't, when you go to your manager asking for a little bit of time or a little bit of resource or suggesting a new idea, and it is a part of their objectives, it shouldn't surprise you that your manager says, could you just stick to your knitting? Because they're probably harming their objective in encouraging you to innovate.
That actually happened to me. So I was in the 90s heading up a digital department in a medical advertising agency, and I wanted to do some more things, and I wasn't allowed to because they said, it's the most profitable division, just keep doing what you're doing. I was like, but I want to add this. And so, I remember that a long time ago in my youth.
It's true. And of course, as I said before, when organizations are doing well and they have, highly profitable products and services, that's when they're at most danger for their culture to be anti-innovative.
Yeah.
It's so easy to default into total exploit mode.
Yeah.
I.e. just exploit your cash cows.
Yeah.
And then you stop innovating to create the next innovations that you're going to need in place before those cash cows die.
Yeah. What I did was quit my job and start my first company in Tokyo.
I love Tokyo. I'm totally supportive of that decision.
Well, I had to make a decision. Do I move countries and start a company, or do I just stay where I am?
For a penny, I say.
Exactly. Or a yen in this case.
Or a yen for a yen.
So my big thing is I'm really passionate about pharma needing to change their business model, you know, go back to the customers, understand the needs, their healthcare needs beyond just taking a pill and redesign the model. How would you advise pharma to think about in terms of innovating their business models?
Well, like my three questions I mentioned earlier, I want to make this very simple and very practical. I think generally books on strategy are far too big, far too long. I don't think strategy is that complicated. Strategy to me answers three fundamental questions. Who is your customer? What are you offering them? How are you offering it?
Yeah.
And if you want to innovate your business model, simply challenge the assumptions you have around the answers to each of those questions.
Yeah.
And if you can identify an assumption, a long-held belief that either you hold or your company holds or your industry holds or, you know, your competitors hold, and you can turn it on its head and say, well, what if it wasn't that?
Mm.
What would that look like? How might we answer that who or what or how question differently? You're innovating your business model automatically. And you've made that intellectual exercise much easier.
Yeah.
So for example, a great example of that is a how question. So, you know, most people would, if they needed to take medicine for diabetes, that was an injectable, right?
Yeah.
Well, finally, a company said, well, so the how is you inject it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, finally, a company said, what if it wasn't that? Okay, so then that sparks, okay, well, what would that look like? And then you start innovating, you start prototyping, and all of a sudden, boom, you have an inhaler.
Yeah.
So brilliant, so much less invasive, so much less painful, so much easier. Of course, incentivizing or helping your patients to take the medicine because they're not dreading giving themselves the medicine. That's a great example of a very simple strategic innovation that just required turning one assumption around one of those questions around and answering it differently.
And so if you do all of them, you could do great things.
Dramatic things, yes.
Dramatic, yeah. Wow. Well, I've really enjoyed this discussion, and we may have to do another podcast. For anyone listening who wants to connect with Adam, you can go to his website, which is Adam Kingle, AdamKingl.com, and reach out to Adam there. So thank you so much for your time today. Really, really interesting discussion. Really nice to get an external non-farmer perspective on all of this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of AI for Farmer Growth. If you have received huge value from this show, or maybe this episode has highlighted how you can use AI in your company, then we would love for you to support the show by leaving us a 5-star rating. Please make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button on your podcast app now to make sure you never miss an episode.